Offer valid on standard browsers, U.S. only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of, 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. Datemyage.com.
A year from now, 5 years from now, when you look back at the 20, 30 books you read in 2025, you'll remember this one distinctly. She said this was the first book that she wrote where she pretty much winged it.
I need to add struggles to my life. I don't have enough.
Right.
That's what
you,
I need.
You need to write a book about your struggle.
Yeah. I'll title it My Struggle and just be my bald, pasty white ass face. Welcome, welcome everyone to the Toot Around Podcast. My name is Richard.
My name is Austin.
Today we're talking a little bit more intellectual, going a bit more classic. Ursula K. Le Guin, The Lathe of Heaven. I'm excited for this one.
This is our introduction to Lathe of Heaven, to Ursula K. Le Guin.
Yeah, a lot of people get introduced through Wizard of Earthsea. We haven't yet. I believe you started it?
No.
Did you try it?
No.
Hmm.
I bought them. It's one of those where buy it at the bookstore and go, oh, I so want to read this, and then TBRs happen.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think this was a great introduction for myself. I really enjoyed it. And we're going to get into this one. This book is surreal, funky, gets into Taoism, the idea of passive versus active characters and personalities. And so this was a good. This was actually our book club of the month for our Patreon members. So if you're interested in joining our book clubs where we talk about books like this, you can hit the link in the description down below. Check it out.
Heck yeah. This is going to be spoiler-free to start off for this discussion part here. So you're safe for now. We always give our spoiler warnings before we get into it. But you put it right of Taoist themes. It's the type of book that the characters don't matter. They're not bad characters. They serve the theme. It's a thought experiment of a book.
Yes.
It's, hey, Ursula K. Le Guin had some things she wanted to toy around with and make you think.
The characters matter in the sense of their personality types and goals. Like, how does that translate for us? And it is two different clashing personalities. And so those characters do matter. But, like, do the characters themselves have this interesting kind of journey that, like, ultimately, I don't want to get, I guess, too spoiler, but, like, one of the main character is fairly replaceable. But I think it is kind of by design.
Oh, it is by design. The main character's name is George Orr. A nod to George Orwell in 1984, yes. Because Ursula K. Le Guin takes some inspiration from Brave New World, 1984, and books. Because this was written in 1971, for context. It's a sci-fi novel. And the book title, The Lathe of Heaven, is actually a misrepresentation. You looked this up in the interview as well.
Yeah.
It was a misquote of some translation. So it's the title itself, it should be something else, but somebody translated some proverb, or what was it exactly, Rich?
There's a Taoist proverb that she does have in this book that is a mistranslation.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's fine.
Great Move title on. Name.
It's a great title name. It's all okay.
It's all fine. And Ursula, she said that there's an interview out here. We'll post a link below. We'll show some clips when we get into the spoiler part of this review as well. But she said this was the first book that she wrote where she pretty much winged it.
Yeah, I have that in my notes too, by the way. I actually have notes for this one. I know.
Golf claps all around.
But no, that was one of the interesting things I found with seeing the interview from her, is most of the books she does have a fairly good plan, or she at least does think it through. It doesn't seem like she's too much of a plotter or pantser. She's somewhere in between, generally. But this one, due to the nature of the plot, it's hard to actually make a concrete outline for this plot. So to give you back of the book spoilers, on the back of this book, George is an individual who sometimes when he dreams, his dreams become reality, and he's left with being the only one that remembers the previous existence, the previous reality. And so he's going through all these problems, trying to stay awake. He's afraid to dream. And he comes into the offices of Dr. Haber, psychologist, and tries to get help with his dreams. And things go awry. That's the plot of the book. It gets a little surreal, gets a little fun, and then you start having questions about consequentialism and the idea of should you be passive in your life? Should you be active, proactive, a proactive will versus a passive will? Which will survive? Like all these great things.
Make decisions or stay complacent.
Yeah.
Noticing Rich is bald again.
Oh,
you
yeah.
made the decision. You said, you know what? I can't afford hair transplant surgery right now.
Okay. Fun.
Aside. Fun, an aside. This,
fun aside.
Just an aside. We'll get back to the book.
I tried for a whole year to regrow my hair.
Mm-hmm.
I took all the medication. I took all the vitamins. I did everything I was supposed to. I got special shampoo, taking finasteride, minoxidil, like the medical strength kind. And I mean, I got vitamin D. I did all the things for a whole year. And I was left with what I had. And I was like going, this ain't enough. I would rather have a full head of hair, which would require a hair transplant surgery. So I would either want that, or I want to be bald again, because I hate the middle ground. I hate balding. So I tolerated it for a year. And then I was like, hey, next bonus check comes in, I'm going to look at it. And if it is within the price range, I'll go get a hair transplant surgery. The quarter didn't do so great.
Not our best quarter.
Not the best quarter.
No, this is for not to ramble. This is, we're talking your job.
Yeah. So like I was looking at that. I was like, I could do other things with that money. Yeah. And I decided I want to buy very nice podcasting chairs more than my hair.
Our asses will appreciate that.
Yes, I'm.
But also, you want something for not just the podcast to record, because you use this as a library. You want somewhere you can come in and read.
Exactly. And I want nice comfortable reading chair. Lounge yeah. chairs. I would never read in this chair. This is an awful reading chair.
I kind of like the swivel. I swivel too much in it.
Don't worry. These chairs will swivel.
Oh, I'm so down. Let's go.
We're there. Leather swivel lounge chairs. Oh. We're going to be in comfort.
I'm so glad your company did so bad. That's amazing. So... George Orr and you are not alike, which people will come to find out
probably
reading this book. And keeping that on the spoiler-free pitch, that's exactly it. George Orr has these dreams, sometimes become reality. Scientists playing around and seeing should you do things? Should you try to create change? Taoist themes, utilitarian consequentialist themes.
Utopian ideas.
Utopian ideas, yes. And our pitch, we had this for our book club of the month, which you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Levy, who pitched this book to everybody, got it selected because the patrons, we come into a pitch meeting where people go, hey, vote for this book. And Rich and I, we host that, and then we host book discussion. So Levy said about this book, it's philosophical sci-fi, wild, silly concept turned into thought-provoking natures. Kendall said, it felt dizzy, and the book be trippy. That was... word for word.
An exact quote.
Exact quote. And we had Melanie, who said, it's about love and life. Keep renewing. Be active. And we had several others. Thank you all for participating in that. Again, check link below for if you want to join up our Patreon. But then this also has on Goodreads a 4.13 rating. And it's not the Rambler rating, though. So disregard it, that.
Yeah,
disregard.
If you want to think about it, but you don't need it. Yeah.
You don't need it. For our Rambler rating.
Yes.
Okay, what's your Richard Rambler rating for The Lathe of Heaven?
I gave this an official 3.5. out of five. I think this is
okay.
A good book.
Did that lower since we book club? Well, you slightly. Had a gut reaction to it. Yeah,
I had
yeah.
a gut reaction.
Yeah,
it ever so slightly right after book club, or like right after I finished reading, going into book club, I had it at a 3.75.
You did okay.
Lowered it by 2.25.
Okay, I'm remembering 4.25. I thought you had it higher. Oh, dang. Because I just don't like it when we agree. I also have a 3.5. So.
Ah, darn it.
I'm just trying to find disagreement because I also gave it 3.5 stars, which means good on our scale. You could see our scale here of how it works. We also have in our description a description of how the Ramble rating system works down below. We added that in the description below. Descriptions. That's a lot of what I did. And also what Ursula K. Le Guin does, because the best part about her book here to me was the prose.
I would agree with you. I would say tied for that would be the thought-provoking nature.
Got it.
In the sense of, we'll get into it.
Yes.
The thought-provoking nature is not a 5 out of 5 for me, but I think it was really well done. I think it was great for the book it was, especially with the size.
Yeah, so the reason for my 3.5 good, it's a well-done book. And I would say I've tackled these themes in other books. And you from chapter one, the reason we're able to say all this in the spoiler-free section is it's apparent from chapter one what theme this is tackling. And so the book gives examples of that theme, and it's well done, but doesn't do anything that went, oh, a revelation for me or anything new. I got the point. Although it's well done enough that it's impressive, but just good.
I think for the message it's going for, I think it does it a great job at its message. There's not really too many like flaws in it. Does it do it in a maybe unique way for the time, especially?
It's yes, unique, so. Yeah.
Nowadays, especially, you know, time has passed. People have copied things. Yeah. You kind of see utilitarianism and consequentialism, all these kind of things before. I think the little sliver that this one does it well is combining that together with Taoism and Taoism practices. I think that's a bit more unique generally. So yeah.
And for people that want to pick up the book, it's 12 chapters, super short. It's not a novella necessarily. It's a short novel.
Yeah.
So it's quick to read. I would say with our good ratings, recommend, don't throw it on your TBR. Like, oh, you got to read this. However, if this kind of book, it fits your, oh, I want a thought experiment, and you've been reading a lot of actions, and you go, I want something unique. This is unique. It is trippy. It is interesting. You'll read this book and not, I think the thing is, a year from now, 5 years from now, when you look back at the 20, 30 books you read in 2025, you'll remember this one distinctly.
Yeah.
It stands out.
There's also just a real, I have to appreciate that Ursula K. Le Guin is actually a very good writer.
Oh, yeah.
And just, she could write pretty, like, she can write drivel, and yet she's such a good writer that it comes through and it's memorable. Mm-hmm. So there's something to be said of maybe the ideas, like, you can see this kind of stuff before, but it's packaged in her prose that is done very succinctly. And so I enjoy it. So
that's good. Yeah.
I definitely don't regret reading this book. I thought it was a good book. Yeah. I'd hope other people read it too.
Definitely. And before we go into spoiler territory, we have a quick ad from our sponsor. Before we continue with our Lathe of Heaven review, here's a quick shout out to our sponsor, World Anvil.
World Anvil is a site with world building, character development, and plot mapping tools to help you create a story.
Whether it's for your D&D campaign, an indie book, or just you want to do something for fun, World Anvil provides tools such as map making, the family lineage spreadsheets, and all sorts of gadgets to kind of help you put whatever this head of yours has conjured up into a story, fun board game, or like Lathe of Heaven has, an extremely complex timeline review of a bunch of crap. So.
Yeah. So you check out worldanvil.com with our link in the description and use the code RAMBLE, that's RAMBLE, at checkout for a 51% off a yearly subscription.
If you don't want to commit to a subscription, you can also just go to World Anvil, check out their free tier, and if you end up really liking it, then upgrade to their tier where you use the code RAMBLE and get a subscription to their site. We really appreciate it. It supports us. Thank you, World Anvil, for supporting us and for you guys for watching this review and this ad. Yeah. And
all those people that just, you know, double tap the screen and, you know, skip through the ad.
There's a lot of
them. A little moment from us. I just want to know. We appreciate you.
We do. Unless
you either you're stuck in the car and can't skip the ad, or you let us watch, and I appreciate you.
Or they're trying to skip. They're skipping by 10 seconds at a time, and they landed at this.
That could be true.
And now they're going, damn, I didn't skip ahead far enough to get out of the ad. You're in an ad loop.
Oh, well.
No, anyway, let's keep them here. No, keep them here.
Keep them here longer.
And
now back to the
back
video.
Back to the review. Bye.
Thank you very much, World Anvil. Now we're back into the review.
Yes.
Full spoiler warning. We're going to get into the book and all the dirty details.
Why dirty? What?
I don't know.
You always got to add stuff like that.
I do.
we're clean details. It is
a clean book.
What's that? Oh, what's Mr. Clean? You look like Mr. Clean. So very
that is true.
Clean details for this.
I will say the day I just like go clean shaven in the beard, then I'm Mr. Clean.
No, you keep the beard because you look as if you have more hair than me just because of the beard. Together we create
that.
A full man. Just put my nosing up and your nosing down and we're something. Okay, spoiler warning, emotional impact. What'd you give it out of 5 stars?
I gave it a 3.25.
Above average.
Above average.
I gave 3.5, good.
Yeah.
I felt good about it.
Emotional impact, the characters did not particularly draw me in completely. It's not a, the emotional beats I wasn't super, super attentive to, but it was above average.
Well, when you say what emotional beats is it going for?
I think some of it is going for shock and like absurdism. Because there's definitely moments when everything changes and like you go, what the hell's going on? To me, yeah, I've seen it before. Like, I get it. So the absurdism is not as absurd to me.
Aliens. Yeah. What the heck?
Aliens. So there's that aspect. I don't know. I guess maybe the thrill of what is George going to do. I think I kind of got it from the beginning. So it's above average, but I wouldn't particularly say good emotional connection.
I think I'll change your mind to go 0.25 higher when I show you this movie clip. Okay. There's this.
I haven't seen the movie yet.
I didn't watch the full movie. I skipped around to look for certain scenes.
Ah.
And thank you, Scott, for sending the movie over after the book club. Thank you, Scott. And so Le Guin said, when it came to adapting her books, she has had a whole catalog at this point, and she was reached out to by somebody in the industry that wanted to adapt one of her books. And she was shocked that it was this one because she said, I quote, nothing happens in it. So she said nothing happens in it. Why would you adapt this one? Because it's just such a weird, wacky book.
Well, in that same interview, she was, she said that the book that she won turned into an adaptation was actually The Left Hand of Darkness, which we do have to get to.
We will read that.
I have heard very many good things about it. Yes. I also watched a Jared Henderson video about the book. I'm now very intrigued to read it.
He thinks highly of it?
Yes.
Oh, good.
So I'm interested in reading that, but yeah, it's kind of funny. The movie itself, she's like, nothing happens in this book. It's dreams and things like...
It's weird.
A bunch of things continuously don't happen. Like over and over again. By the end, a lot of things didn't happen.
And there's a mixture. The realities are all confused.
Yeah, but like,
the author's saying this, not us. She's saying nothing happens. And this is just a quick clip to give you the vibe of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's peak cinema.
George, wake up. What? Something's wrong.
What's the matter?
Don't you hear that?
What did you tell me to dream?
That everything's okay. The alien's off the moon.
That's it. They're off the moon. They're here.
Aliens! You just gotta love the TV to movie type.
Oh, yeah.
PBS movies back in the day. But back in the day, we weren't alive then. But, you know, you watch them.
Hey, I have a fond appreciation for classic special effects that were, you know, not as popular. I can appreciate it.
Yeah, because you couldn't lean as heavily on it.
I personally really love the original Star Trek and Lost in Space. And yeah, are the special effects great? No, but it has spunk.
Charm.
It has heart.
Yes.
You can tell they're doing their best.
Is that what the charm is? Because you can make fun of all the modern CGI and go, well, yeah.
Yeah.
You're trying too hard.
Well, no, I look at that and go, like, you're trying not hard enough.
Oh, you could do better? That's how you're looking at it?
They threw money at a problem where I want to see creativity.
Mm.
Where you take, like, Doctor Who and you go, like, oh, Daleks, this alien robot hybrid monster. And they're like, oh, what do we use for hands? Like, we got to build this prop and things. It's like, the hands are kind of hard to do. What should we do for the arms? Plunger hand.
Yes.
I got that. Like, we don't have the tools. Bathroom. Plug it in.
It's why it's practical great. Effects too are always preferable because the creativity behind it of Lord of the Rings having forced perspective with to show Frodo Baggins, to show Elijah Wood being much smaller than Ian McClellan. So that's always cool. But then the special effects of you look at that, it just gives you nostalgia too.
Here's a thing to like another aside of I have to appreciate Michael Bay. Like as a director, as a filmmaker,
yeah,
he actually does a wonderful blend of in his action of practical and CGI. Like he actually goes out of his way to do the explosions and does a lot of cable work to actually throw the cars. He doesn't just like all CGI action flick.
I didn't know that. I've not watched a lot of Michael Bay.
I gotta appreciate it to a certain degree. Respect. Like at least you're doing the real film work of big cable and flip the car.
You're doing the Tom Cruise.
Yes.
He does his stunts.
I don't know. I have a soft spot.
Oh, I didn't know that about him.
I like that more than James Cameron's Avatar of just endless CGI slop.
I don't like those movies because of the story, but it looks top tier. It just, it looks flawless.
Yeah, but I'm...
Technology, like yeah.
Yeah.
I understand it. It does look very pretty.
I like when Michael Bay actually makes the boom go boom.
We'll do anything except talk about The Lathe of Heaven. But this is a review. We promise. The Lathe of Heaven, the emotions we talked about so far, it's going for shock value, you said?
Yeah, it's the absurd and shock value. And ultimately, I think it is mostly going for the thought-provoking nature of it. So the emotional connection of the characters. I don't think you're supposed to like care a lot about George or care a lot about some of these characters. I think they have their moments, but that's not a focus.
Yeah. I think we think pretty much the same across the board on this. Why I'm a little higher than you.
Go ahead.
Why I think it's good is the one thing this did for me, I always appreciate some novelty or some unique spin. And this book will sit with me longer than others in the space. And just because of that, I was hooked, and I was hooked with the premise, and that premise was enough for me to go, oh, I was pushing through this, read it pretty quickly. I enjoyed that there wasn't a dead spot. I could read it in one sitting. So for me, that was accomplished pretty well.
Yeah.
As far as what was the biggest moment of, oh my God, I can't believe that. There wasn't any of that. So that's why it's not any higher. It was consistently engaging.
Sure.
It was engaging, yeah. But would you say there was a moment for you where the book grabbed you? Because I guess what I was saying there was the premise of George's dreams becoming real. That was enough of a hook. Was there something else beyond that hook that you went, oh, that's also another, doesn't have to be a twist, but something that elevated it emotionally for you?
Sure. I think the relationship between George and the lawyer starts off with your kind of, okay, classic sci-fi romance of, you know, boy sees girl in book and immediately they're in love type of deal.
Yeah.
However, just over time, I kind of bought it. Like, often it's more of a thing about lust and attraction and more just like throw it into the sci-fi book and it doesn't mean anything. But the fact that the romance in this book actually had a point, and by the end of it really made, I thought made me think of the ending of how George treats his relationship of he has to grieve the loss of his previous wife and instead of lamenting or trying to fight a way to like get her back. Takes like he realizes that this woman, the woman, a version of the woman that he loved is right in front of him and he could try again.
Yeah.
I thought that was touching. Also, the scene where they basically, you know, they fall in love and they, I don't know, Le Guin's description of like making love is not a one-time action. It is like bread. It needs to be kneaded and developed over time. And like, I don't know, it was just a short passage. It's like, that's heartwarming. I thought the relationship worked pretty well for it.
Sci-fi written by a woman seems... Yeah. The relationship worked better.
Yeah.
William Gibson in Neuromancer, we always refer to that as just the... I mean, it's also cyberpunk.
Yeah.
So it's supposed to fit that genre.
Well, that's the thing with that character. Like, the romance was nothing, but I liked the female character, the main female lead in Neuromancer. Mm-hmm. I thought was a really interesting character, and I was engrossed in her backstory, and like I was emotionally tied to her. But the relationship, not so much.
Got it. Anything else for emotion you want to talk about?
Sure. What do you think Ursula K. Le Guin was actually going for? Like, especially from her interview, she talked about what she was going for this book. Mm-hmm. What do you think she was trying to get out of it?
Oh, I think
out of people.
From her saying that she didn't know where this book was going because it was literally dreams.
Mm-hmm.
I think the format of this book, and I'll lean into thought-provokingness, but we'll talk about this more next category. I think it came across very clearly that she was throwing in new scenarios to support her theme and to support her idea, the Taoism, and also the utilitarianism that it tackles. So for her, it was just throwing, solving war, having peace on Earth. Solving so nobody's racist, solving world hunger, all of these things that you would want to do if you had a genie bottle, but mm-hmm. then not realizing the consequences of it, as long as it's framed in a, from George Orr's point of view, has to happen in a rational way. It can't just happen without consequences because our human mind is not capable of having war without there being a reason why, or having peace without there being a reason for peace, such as aliens coming, or mm-hmm. the reason people aren't racist. Well, all the colors must change. And I'm leaning more into thought-provokingness, but I think what she was going for is she was adding in scenes to support the overall theme of this. So for her, it was probably fun to go, ooh, what's a unique, unexpected, maybe she wasn't going to floor people with, oh, look at this twist on the thing, but she was throwing curveballs at the wall of, okay, this thing, well, here's the consequences. This thing, well, here's the consequences. And how weird and quirky is that for...
It's constantly the monkey's paw type deal.
Yeah, what's that?
I believe it's a Chinese like proverb reference of like basically being careful for what you wish for, like wishing on the monkey's paw, and like you actually get what you want, but it comes at a cost. And yes. It's like, haha, you got it, but like I wished for world peace, and it's like, well, I'll give it to you, the world is at peace without any people on it. And so you wipe out
yes and so I think that was more the angle of how to get you hooked of these constant twist of what are the consequences, which that more goes into, want to go into thought provokingness.
Yeah.
What did you give that out of 5 stars?
I gave it 4. I thought it was great.
I gave 3.5. Good.
Yeah. I thought this book really connected with me on it of, is it blowing me out of the water? No. But if someone asked me for a book on consequentialism, a taste of Taoist philosophy of, because if you ask the question of Taoist philosophy being a lot about accepting the world as it is and being, you know, doing nothing is actually very often the right thing to do, and accepting the world as it is and making the active choice to, you know, go with the flow, basically. Like, what?
Be the jellyfish.
Be the jellyfish. And trying to explain that in a novel, I think it can sometimes be difficult. especially nowadays, you're normally focused on the active protagonist and like, how can a very passive protagonist be entertaining? I think this book does a really good job at that and shows between Dr. Haber and George, George being very passive will, but not weak, versus Dr. Haber being a very strong-willed or very forceful will, and seeing how both of those come together, and ultimately George, the passive will, is the one that survives.
He has to
and
be why. Active by the end, right?
Yeah, but like he chooses his time. Mm-hmm. But there's a moment of like, you know, with Dr. Haber constantly pushing, constantly forcing it, and ultimately breaks. George constantly rolling with the punches, going with the flow, and having to survive long enough to like waiting for his moment to actually make a decision. And like, it doesn't take much, but timed right, it was the right one. So I think that there was a good explanation of those type of philosophies and those type of personality traits.
Do you think it would have been good of him to figure that out earlier?
Possibly. It could be nice, but then we wouldn't have a book.
Then we wouldn't have a book. George, you should stop eating the jellyfish right now. Six billion people died. Yeah. So with that Taoist theme, there's a clip of Ursula K. Le Guin talking about that for 30 seconds, which can give us context from the author herself. So here we go.
Of course, this is a Taoist book. The Taoism was pretty conscious.
What do you mean by that? A lot of people say, what does she mean, a Taoist book?
Well, just in the crudest sense, that Taoism says you do things by not doing things. And all attempt to do and to set things right and to make things happen eventually backfires.
There are no bad guys in this book. That's one of the things that struck me.
I'm not very good at bad guys.
Why?
I don't know.
You don't see the
I'm
world?
Just so sweet naturally. I don't know.
She does seem very sweet.
She does.
And so that is her her explaining that it was very conscious. It was obviously
I dropped the remote.
it was obviously intended to come across that way. This entire book's very intentional. And that's the one thing. I my biggest takeaway was the utilitarian aspect, the consequentialist. And I guess we're assuming people know what that is, but do you want to give context for what is that philosophy?
Sure. I mean, utilitarianism boils down to essentially the ends justify the means. Like the most amount of good for the most amount of people. It's basically it. And so you can talk all about it. The ultimate flaw comes down to that of you have to ask yourself, does your end goal is your good the same good for everyone? So one, you have to define what's good. That's the first step.
And how do you put a number on that?
And then how do you put a number on it? And then ultimately, if you have a never ending good, and I think this is a point of the book, is if your goals are ever forward thinking, if the good that you are going for is an ultimate good, is an unlimited good, like utopia, then anything done in that pursuit is justified. I mean, it's constantly, you look at history, that's a lot of history, but still.
And you see from the examples, some referred to before, but these were four big ones, see if I'm missing any, but the overpopulation, to Haber wanted to solve overpopulation, and the only way that George could rationalize that was eliminating humans. Many of them that there wasn't a problem. Yeah. Wants no cancer, disease is gone, everybody healthy. Well, eugenics is the result of that, because if you don't want that to continue on into lineages, you have to kill people who have certain diseases. War end, all peace, alien invasion happens. No racism, everyone becomes gray, the same color, so that people can't be prejudiced. So all these examples of, hey, look, to solve the problem, look at the consequences. And part of that message is utopia possible? Whose utopia is it? Good for who? Obviously, Haber's power is increasing throughout the book as well. That's more character stuff. But that's very clear. And that utilitarian aspect of the book, anything else you have to say on that? Or it's obviously very clear what it's going for. As you said, it's a good thing you could say to somebody who wants to learn more about the topic, I guess, and say, hey, this book discusses it and lays out what consequentialism is, what utilitarianism is to somebody. Mm-hmm. Now, I think defenders of utilitarianism would sure. look at it much differently and argue a different point. But
yeah, but point with this book is everything that Haber tries to get George to do with his dreams. What I took from it was no matter what George dreamed, and his dreams have this ultimate power of basically altering reality. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing he really never changed was the human condition. All of the solutions to problems, the boundary, the fence around his mind was always like he can't change human nature. So he always changed the circumstances to get the end goal. So,
sorry, Haber did or
George? When George is dreaming,
it is making sure
he would never. He can't dream of a reality of which human beings are fundamentally different. Mm. So he had to change the circumstances. And I think almost every single case is like, you know, with overpopulation being a factor, like. Technically, if human beings were more like every single human being just had more conscious determination over how their own population grows, and if I don't know, if scarcity wasn't a thing, then all these problems wouldn't be really existing. But scarcity is a fundamental factor, and he didn't change that. He didn't change how a lot of humans actually populate the earth. Ultimately, every single species will grow in population until they physically can't, until people starve. That's generally how all animals grow. It's like their population will go until there's not enough food, and then starvation is what stops them. So the more food humans make, guess what? There's going to be more humans.
Population explosion because industrialization happens, agriculture, and who is that? Is it Franz Haber was the inventor of, I had this at one point down, but took ammonia and was able to fertilize plants at a much faster,
Yes.
Franz Haber, look into that. And Franz Haber also helped create in World War I for Germany a lot of the poisonous gas used as well. So both... The one of the creators, I don't quote me, just double check this, but Franz Haber, he both created an agricultural technology to allow human population to explode and millions of billions of people result in increased capacity to live on this earth. But then at the same time, gave weapons of war that caused death and suffering and torture. What a complex.
Now, there's actually something interesting about the population of all the things I've said.
Yeah.
Or not entirely true. That is generally true of like all animals. Like animals definitely do that. But when you deal with humans, that is at some point that becomes the case and then it stops. Like take a lot of Western nations of we have as much food as you need. I know people are starving. I get it. But generally speaking, food increases, the access to food increases, and yet population is decreasing. And so you have to ask why. And then
many social factors for that.
Many social factors.
Yes.
I think often it's when a lot of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs are actually met, there seems to be less of a motivating factor to actually have children. Because one of the reasons why you have children is for labor and to help you in your age. That's a lot of it. So,
well, there's so many reasons where that would be a video on its own of why do more developed nations, more modernized nations have less children. 10 things come to mind. When you're watching this right now, you can go, yes. It's this, and this. We should do that video on that of just the random.
Sure.
Why do developed countries have a decrease? And then that's just a random Tuesday upload.
Yeah, no, the video could just be, why ain't they fucking?
Just, it's got to be on the Tudor Ramble level. We can't, yes. We can't try to act all highbrow.
We're not there yet. Yeah.
We'll read a book of that. And so that, any other point you wanted to make on the themes and messaging? Also, there's themes that our patrons are talking about dreams and dream making and how it touched on dreams in general. Anything you garnered from that?
Yeah, I'm not as well read in the actual, like, the structure of dreams and how do dreams actually function. From what I heard from our patron members, that how it's described in this book, other than the reality warping part, is pretty accurate of, you know, the different stages of sleep and when you actually, what are the purpose of dreams to often to contextualize memories and actually move things from short-term to long-term memory. And then this book takes the step further of taking your subconscious and making it the meta consciousness. So, interesting. But I wanted to ask you on, I think it's an important thing to Le Guin, and I mentioned it, but I want to hear what your thoughts are on the struggle between a passive and a forceful will. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are, I've experienced it on this podcast for 200 something episodes. Anything you say. Yeah, what do you want? But on a passive versus a forceful will, I like that she puts extremes to make a point. Mm-hmm. That's what books are for a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Hey, look at this extremely passive, nothing milquetoast character that at the description of George. Okay, I'll say that for characters, but what are my thoughts on that message? Or what are my thoughts on that?
That message of it based on Taoism, the idea of like the best thing to do often is to do nothing, and like doing nothing is a choice. You need to be like the jellyfish.
To me, I guess my take this, it's good mess. It was a good theme for the book. With that being said, I think I'd want to read something else on Taoism. Mm-hmm. To me, it's not, I don't know if she's trying to defend it or trying to make a point of this is what you should do. I don't think she's saying, hey, this is how to live or this is what you should do. Mm-hmm. She's exploring something. It's an experiment.
Sure.
I think what I've looked at this and gone, Haber and George both don't come across as the moral righteousness or an example to follow, because the jellyfish nature of George of not doing anything causes so much damage. And then finally he acts eventually, I guess, is the message then to act eventually, to not be a jellyfish. Is that one interpretation of it? Or is it, hey, he was being passive and Haber was the one doing wrong. Was he doing wrong is a question. I think so. You tell me, audience. So on Haber's end of having this messed up utopia causing, I lean more toward virtue ethics than I do consequentialism anyways, but then having Haber commit all these atrocities and having this power hungry narcissistic nature to him and being a forceful will, I think both of them, it kind of showed that neither was 100% correct. And so when I'm exploring Taoism, I would like to see from a different Taoist book of why is that a great philosophy to you? And I'd love to learn about it. This one gave me an extreme, and I'm not going, oh, I see why everybody's Taoist. I understand the point of a jellyfish and being more passive natured, and I could see a better defense of that. I don't know if this book wasn't necessarily going for a defense of it, so that's not a critique of the book. It's just more so I want to explore that in a different one, because this is just more so, okay, I see someone extremely passive, someone extremely forceful. I get it. They're not good examples of human beings to me.
I look at this book, and it does make me think of Sun Eater in the sense of, I don't think this is really a spoiler where...
Yeah, don't be careful. Don't be spoiling the best. Like,
the characters are a bit... The main characters has a forceful will of, like, if he doesn't act, then nothing will change. And a lot of, like, it takes a strong will to affect change in the world. Mm-hmm. But depending on the situation, I think this book really gets at, depending on the situation, normally a life of chaos, and in chaotic situations, it is better to be like the jellyfish, that trying to force something in chaos will often lead to unforeseen disastrous results. I think that's kind of the point of it, of at least I saw the message of only a personality like George could survive what he went through, that he could go however many years of his life constantly seeing reality change around him, and he has to go with the punches. If he was too forceful, he would crack. like Haber did when he finally got to experience it at the end, he cracked instantly. His mind broke and he couldn't handle that chaotic change where George is able to roll with punches and choose his moments.
I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. It's directly related to characters. Can we set your character score? And
yeah, go ahead.
Close this question. I gave 3.25 above average to characters.
I did too.
So you both above average?
Yes.
A question for you is, would George, he's such a passive character, mm-hmm. so much like the jellyfish, he was too passive to even kill himself.
Yes.
Is there a moral justification for his being in his position to kill himself? Would that have been the virtuous thing to do?
I think it's an understandable, but I don't know. I mean, I personally see I put value in human life of I don't think it is morally right to kill yourself. I think there clearly are exceptions where you go like, man, I get it. Like a life of constant pain or a life in George's case of constantly affecting reality where causing the deaths of untold billions or the unmaking, not really deaths often, but the unmaking of billions. But then I think George does come across the question of what if there are other people just like me? What if this is how reality is?
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
I'm not actually any different, and like my death is not going to cause anything. I think he even toys with the idea of like, what if I'm like a reset of when an apocalypse happens, I'm someone like me is there to reset reality, to run back the clock, to fix things. I played with an idea enough that I was like, I understand why he wouldn't want to kill himself.
It's in his character, yeah. Yeah. As well.
I mean, there's plenty of reasons not to, and mm-hmm. so he shouldn't.
No, it made sense in the story as well. It's mm-hmm. just that moral dilemma of he was thinking that, contemplating it, and you see genuine reasons for why you would in that case, mm-hmm. but you see why he didn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, he's being passive, but he at least thinks it out. He understands that there's plenty of reasons not to, mm-hmm. and to isolate himself, thinking that he is the only one with these kind of abilities, is definitely a reason to hold his hand on that decision.
The way he's described in the book, it harbors looking at George for the first time. He says, there was an acceptant, passive quality about him that seemed feminine or even childish. Haber recognized in himself a protective, bullying reaction toward this physically slight and compliant man. To dominate, to patronize him was so easy as to be almost irresistible. That's just how passive George is. And it's funny, you said something in the book club that was great, because on our scale of when we're rating characters, again, we have description below, a document of what we mean by each of our categories. Our 5 stars for characters are irreplaceable. Mm-hmm. You can't replace these characters. They're so real, so unique that they're not just an archetype. Our 1 star is incoherent. Going, why'd you pick this character? Doesn't make sense. Not the best one for the story, but also just what are their motivations? Why are they doing this? But in the middle, that 3 stars, okay, you could replace them.
Yeah.
This is a replaceable character. It's funny because you mentioned this with George is literally a replaceable character, purposefully so. He's
yes,
but
and
he's
no
the most,
too.
But like, he's the most irreplaceable, replaceable character, is what you said. And
yeah,
did you have anything else?
He
on
is
that?
So passive, and that like that he is almost not a character in his inaction.
Yeah,
but that in and of itself is so unique, like. I'm trying to think of a character that is that passive, of that willing to go with the flow and willing to weather.
Not to George's thing, but there's some Discworld characters that are just, okay,
yeah,
Mort. I mean, not the same, but characters just going more so out of, we could say, ignorance versus George's moral contemplation.
Yeah, where yeah. It starts to become like, okay, George is his own man,
yeah.
Is you see the level of trauma he goes through and he still gets up and continues. Mm-hmm. And there's something like a bit more admirable about him. It's one thing to say like, oh, being passive, and it's like, oh, that's being nothing. Being able to deal with the level of stress that he goes through is genuinely impressive at a certain point, especially. And so he becomes a strong character over time as you see him.
And that is why Ursula K. Le Guin began the story and ended with a jellyfish. She ended it with jellyfish, right? Yeah, I believe so. Mm-hmm. And that is why jellyfish is there. He's supposed to represent that jellyfish. George Orr, and she was talking highly in the interview, she talked about too, jellyfish, they've survived millions and millions of years, and yeah. they go with the wave, they go with the flow, the Taoism. And so George having that passive nature, Haber's, what did you think of Haber and his opposite nature?
I think less of Haber as a character. It's more of, maybe he doesn't start out evil. He just kind of is kind of well-meaning. But how I see the character, I know Le Guin says she doesn't really write villains. But the very first thing Haber did once he knew about George's power was give himself more power and authority. And that was the only consistent thing he did through the dreams. Every time he forced George to dream, he got a bigger office. He got a bigger position. And chaos of the world kind of be damned. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to try that. But does he go back and try and fix it? No. He's like, I'm going to solve world peace. Well, damn, that didn't work. I'm going to go with world hunger. Ah, look at all those problems. But the consistent thing he did every time was enrich himself. And so I'm like, narcissistic, self-serving, genuinely not a good guy. I don't think
manipulative.
I don't think he has great intentions.
No.
At all.
Now, to himself, he is well-intentioned because he wants the world to be a better place and he wants to fix these things. Look, there's now no longer war. There's no longer racism. There's no longer all these bad things. Now, the cost of those things were what is the question. But to Haber, every villain thinks they're the hero.
Yeah,
I would consider him. I would say he's the villain. I know there's word of in the interview, Le Guin was even saying that she doesn't write villains. Mm-hmm. To me, Haber takes that with stride. Even if you're well intentioned, the good intentions do not mean you're always the best person. Now, I want to caveat that with the scale of Haber. Okay, if someone's well intentioned and sorry, I meant to walk through the door without hitting you, but I accidentally did. Sorry, man. Like, it's a good person.
This book is a good example of intentions of what someone says and then judging them by the actions. That's why I was kind of emphasizing of like
the power.
See what he actually got out of every dream. The only consistent thing he did every time.
You're right.
Didn't go back to fix a mistake. That never happened. He tried once at solving world hunger and then never tried it again. But what did he do again? Give himself even more authority, more power, more status, more prestige. Mm-hmm. No matter what he says his intentions are, that's what he did. And that's clearly what that's what his actual intentions were.
I should say this too, because I'm talking from the intentions of a more virtue ethic framework of you care about each individual, mm-hmm. where when he's saying he's well-intentioned, look at the greater good he's doing, right?
Yeah.
Where it comes across villainous, when I'm using that term, is look at how he also treats George, manipulating, deceiving George, doesn't care about his well-being because he's doing stuff for the better, which just, if you agree with that kind of ethical code of every individual human has human right, is deserving of moral respect and authority in that case, and doesn't treat him that way because of outside justifications, that's where he comes across. He's enriching himself, like you're saying, and treating George like this. So he comes across as, even if it's self-serving, could be one thing because he's making himself more powerful, but he at the very least doesn't care about George's well-being.
Well, yeah. I think this is a great example of the, a good example to see the virtue of virtue ethics is no matter what you say about the greater good in numbers of like, oh, I'm going to save X amount of people. I think it is a really good example to see, like, how do you treat the individual is important, because by that you can see what you really mean by treating people as a group. To try and lump humans in as a group and trying to do the greater good and then forget about the individual, you'll sacrifice a lot of individuals. So it just kind of goes to show how weak his greater goals are, especially with how he thinks about it. Mm-hmm. Of, oh, I'm going to solve world hunger and never coming back to it again. Is like, yeah, maybe he says he's going to do the greater good, but what is he actually doing? Yeah. It feels so half-hearted. And that's kind of the word, like, if you find yourself going like, oh, I'm going to treat this individual poorly because I'm going to do the greater good elsewhere, I question what your greater good actually is. Mm-hmm. I question your intentions with that. Like,
absolutely.
How you treat the individual will often be how you treat the larger group.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, don't trust someone's words, trust their actions.
And a lot of this, too, maybe representative of we think the book's good. Yeah. Somebody else might think this is better. Somebody else might think it's worse. But the reason we stand in that spot, too, before this podcast started, a lot of the reason we started this, if we just have late night conversations all the time, that transitioned in the books one day, but religion, philosophy, et cetera. So this stuff we're just naturally interested in. And so prior to reading this book as well, we've obviously have a stance or know what we think about ethics. And we're also confused about ethics too, because it's self-contradictory. There's a lot of things to think through. But I guess when looking at a book like this, or tell me if you agree, because we always talk about this stuff. But when people discuss ethics, usually it centers around these three standards of people are looking at the intentions, the consent, and the well-being, future well-being. Those are usually the three standards where any ethical system will look and touch upon and say, okay, how much do intentions matter? How much does the consent of the other person matter? And then how much does the well-being and the future well-being of said individuals matter? That is ethics in a nutshell, or whether it's religious or secular, of what people are trying to grapple. And usually I find when all three of those are good, so your well intentions, the person is great. And by the way, just to give an example of like where consent is an issue, where you think like, oh, let's say somebody's you're at a beach and somebody is passed out and needs CPR, can't consent to that, but you go say that. No one would say that's a bad thing, just as an example.
Legally speaking, there's also implied consent for that specific situation.
Yes. So that's why you see, so this isn't a bare all thing, but with all three of those, if usually there's well intentions, there's consent, and the well being is also good, all three of those things, everybody will generally agree if you're not a psychopath. Oh, good. When one of those is off, that's where you get into moral ambiguity. One said segment of those, that's just my think of how I've internalized or explained it to myself, but.
I mostly agree.
Yeah.
However, there is often consent and well-being, I think, are the most conflicting. A person who's addicted to heroin consents to heroin, but also hurts their well-being. Then you have to ask yourself, if someone's addicted to something, is that really their problem? Is that pure consent, or is that, you know, a drug and outside factors kind of influencing it? Because how much can you really say like a drug addict is consenting to continued use of harmful drugs? Is it a false consent?
Yeah. But
children is the easiest one of children can't consent. The parent is focused on well-being over consent.
Mm-hmm. And are they well-intentioned and your well-being?
Yeah.
And the child says, no, I don't want, well, you have to go to school.
No, you're going to school. Yeah.
When all three don't agree, it's not always morally ambiguous. There's people would still say, okay, kid doesn't want to go to school, but your well intentions and it's good for them. Of course, that's a good thing.
But then you have things like, you know, Brave New World 1984 kind of really go all in on, hey, consent is, you know, irrelevant. It's all about the perceived well-being. And what does that well-being actually mean? Is it quality of life? Is it length of life? All of these factors. So you're right. It is a factor of all things, all three of those things together. Personally, I think consent is like my issue. Like today is like hearing like people talk like, oh, consent is the only thing that matters. And I'm like, no.
Intentions and well-being.
That's not enough. You need more than that. Like that is.
Keep going.
Necessary. Consent is necessary. But then you need more. Like it's not enough. Like it's a constant problem. I personally.
Oh yeah, yeah. I get you. And then in that same case that you gave a good example of the kid being forced to go to school, not kids like that. But then let's say then they're 18 and the parents' well intentions and for their well-being wants their kid to go to college. Mm-hmm. Kid doesn't want to go to college. Okay, a bit murkier. Maybe it's still a good thing. Okay, kid finishes college. Go to graduate school. Kid finish graduate school. Go to law school.
Yeah.
Kid finish law. So at what point in that consent to parent ratio, you get what I mean? Obviously, it changes because you're an adult and 18, so that shifts things. So maybe people would say right away. But with those things, just it gets gray when you add in one of those factors being off sometimes.
Sure.
Let's start reading some more philosophy because obviously the Lathe of Heaven has it touches on things. It gives us an excuse to talk about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about Miss Lelek.
Yes.
We did not yet. Any thought? I mean, just quick quote here of the contrast amused Haber, the harsh, fierce woman, the meek, characterless man. So it just gives you a quick.
I liked her well enough as a side character. I think she was quirky enough. I think by the end it was more endearing between her and George, but not too much thoughts on her. What about you?
Yeah, no, good to give some the cool ending of they have to rekindle and reform, was a interesting aspect to George.
Yeah, and then also some of the tragedy of. When he goes to the reality of like, the gray world where everyone is mostly the same, and he sees this, you know, this passionate woman that he fell in love with initially.
That's the best part.
Becoming so passive and so gray and so similar. And he does fall, they do get married, they, you know, have this life together. He does love her, but there is something lost there of the spark was gone. I think that it also is a contributing factor of why by the end he is happy to rekindle this new relationship with the same woman again because he sees that spark in her again, that what he missed. Maybe I'm reading too much into that factor of it, but it's...
Yeah.
I thought that was well done.
Yeah, you remind me, that's probably my favorite part about her character is her... She's black, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and so...
I guess for the context of the book, and this was the interesting part, was... She is half black, half white.
Half black, half
and
white.
And that's why that's right. In the gray world specifically, she isn't born. It was the world after that where she is like, it's no one's gray anymore, but people are a lot more subdued. I'm trying to remember how exactly it worked, but in the gray world, she could never be born because she was born out of this. The moment between her father and mother of racial conflict that made her who she is of both histories and feeling out of place in both worlds contributed to her kind of aggressive attitude and her kind of jadedness and like this fierce attitude toward other people.
Yes. It made her who she is.
And exactly. So that, Taking away racial differences eliminated her. And for George, that was the personal loss to this gray world.
Ursula K. Le Guin saying, everyone stay prejudiced. It's good for society. I love how it shows that, that is my favorite part. I'm glad you mentioned it because it shows that, well, yeah, it's a great thing if everybody's the same, right? Everybody, look, there's no prejudice. There's no, everyone can sing Kumbaya. But then you look at, out of a bad quality, out of that darkness, light often comes. Even the bad things, which is, again, the theme of these books, even the things that you think would be bad, war and cancer. Well, what are the consequences of that? Not to hammer that home again, but it was another good example of
the extreme to make a point of human beings' lives without conflict is ultimately nothing and a struggle in its own self. And so human beings need some type of struggle, conflict, something to fight against, to rise and overcome. Whether that be prejudice, whether that be nature, whether that be, you know, disease, or literally anything. Yeah. You eliminate all of that, and what are you actually left with as a human experience?
Yeah.
So, but then you ask the question, does that mean we shouldn't try to eliminate struggle at all? And no, obviously not. But
yeah,
something to think about.
It is something to think about. Also, humans are funny, you know?
Yeah, but... To that example, it makes me realize in myself of going, I need to add struggle. Like, I may have my own struggles. I lightly use, my life is fine. It's pretty awesome if I do say so myself. But it means, like, I need to add struggles to my life. I don't have enough.
Right.
That's what I need.
You need to write a book about your struggle.
Yeah. I'll title it My Struggle. It'll just be my bald, pasty, white ass face.
That'll come off great, Rich.
Oh, yeah. I can see no downsides.
Zero downside. Then just speak in German. And then
the optics would just be perfect.
I had something to say at some point there, but that's funnier. I had something, some tangent to go off of. What were you talking about right before that? There was something...
talking about her relationship, gray world.
You said something interesting. I was trying to highlight that before the year struggle thing. Damn it. Damn it. Okay, well, maybe it'll come back to me. Yeah, okay.
Probably wasn't important.
It was something you said that I wanted to highlight. Okay, we'll move on from it. Do you want to go on the plot?
Yeah.
What'd you give plot out of 5 stars?
3.5. I think it was a good plot.
3.75. Really good plot. Really good. Yeah.
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 It's definitely a memorable plot, and with how she was writing this book being one, I sometimes hear authors when they talk about like, oh yeah, the book just like came to me and I just kind of like wrote by this, I just kind of winged it, and you know, the characters spoke to me and then I wrote what they said down, and some of that I'm going like, bullshit. I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, think about it. Like, no, you put some thought into it. You thought like, hey, I want this to happen and how do I get there and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. This is the book where I'm like, I get it. I understand why she had to wing it. There's not really a great way to like thoroughly plot this out and yet be entertaining. If she plotted this out too much, like too well, it wouldn't be as surreal. It would feel a little too scripted, too boxed in and forced, where her winging it was like, okay, she can plan everything within one reality, then the dream happens, and from that on, like, completely different. And so like, she can't plan past the dream. Makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. I really like how, I give a lot to the hook of unique idea. I thought the plot was that was a part that was interesting to me. And what I'll think back to is just more so than the characters, more so than the motion. I'll go, wow, what a neat, surreal. And just talking about the three P's, promise, progress, payoff. We were set from the get-go of, hey, premise is George dreams, changes reality. Throughout the entire book, we get constant examples of that. And the payoff is we get these kind of cool interweaving cryptic alien messages to George, and George accomplishes goal, is active in the end. I think the ending for me was the most, if I had to say, disappointing, where I went, oh, okay.
Ended. Why was the ending disappointing to you? Or well, slightly. The most.
No, if, so, still if you had real to pick good. Something. Yeah. It ended how I thought it would, I guess. I was hoping Ursula K. Le Guin had, I've heard so much about her. So my expectations were, okay, it's Ursula K. Le Guin. What she got in store. I was thinking,
Pure Nessie. Some kind of shock ending.
I was thinking Pure Nessie. I was thinking, what's another good like short book example? Annihilation, one of those. Sure. And whereas this one just went, oh, okay.
Yeah, it ended with
resolution.
The good guy
resolution.
Stop the bad guy, and like it's a bit somewhat bittersweet.
I liked it, but yeah, that was all. And yeah, I'm giving a lot of credit to I will remember this book very well.
Sure.
There's no way there's a lot of books I'm already looking at the bookshelf that I could go, oh, I could tell you two things about that book that we read a year or two ago.
Yeah. No, even books that I like look fondly about, you miss a lot of the details in there, because ultimately a lot of it is just to get to point A to point Z, and you miss a lot of the letters in between there.
Yes. I also want to give credit to two more things. This is also the reason I think it's just more impressive. You know, not 4-star impressive, but it's impressive. Two things. One, the multiple timelines and having to weave that in of just go, okay, where are we? And it kind of making sense. It coming across as, okay, I see where we are. Yeah. Like that's hard to do. And it actually made sense. So we're in 1998 and her future at the time, she wrote this in 1971. Yeah. So it was the future at the time, 1998. We had, there's a crazy graph that I'll have to send Nick to post, because there's this crazy graph you could see of all the timelines that diverged in the book. So that's impressive. But also the package of it, of I like how the theme was interwoven with the characters of, for example, the jellyfish, which we mentioned 1,000 times, but having that as an image, sticking that throughout and just going, okay, everything connects. There's nothing that's out of place. It's just well done.
Yeah. Also, just a wonderful bow tie at the end of, like, from the very beginning, we have George surviving, like, basically a nuclear blast, effectively, and, like, stuck in the girders, and, like, but then how it loops back around to basically the same thing of you see more of the history of what he's gone through. And that not being a one-off, and then him having to basically do the same thing again, but this time with a bit more consequence. He somehow dreamed his way, and I think it is implied that he has lost the ability. He has given away the ability, but I'm not sure.
I thought it was done.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure, like, well, he is.
The way, so Haber's insane.
Yeah.
Because he's still dealing with the realities, and Lelith doesn't know George that well, but George knows Lelith, or has the past and the history.
And the aliens are still there.
Well, yeah, because there's multiple. He didn't revert things back. He didn't just say, hey, we're going to take back all those changes that happened.
He merged some things. Fixed some.
Gotta be the jellyfish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But ultimately made the best of a bad situation.
Yeah.
The world is not ended. He not able to take all the lives back, but able to get some, and able to have some degree of peace.
Yeah.
And ability to rebuild. Yeah. So I think the dreaming stopped by the end. Like, because the last dream he had was one where he couldn't have effective dreams anymore. I think that was part of it.
I think so. And I'd correct you, but I do forget that part. So I think you're right, though.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. But
do you want to go on to world building?
Yeah.
Before we do, remember World Anvil, the sponsor of this episode. Okay. just reminding people, because, you know, you got to give multiple reminders in there.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, you got to.
If you want to build your own world, World Anvil's where it's at. Ramble.
See, World Ramble Anvil has those tools to get to map out things like how Ursula, the nice graph.
Yes, if you want that. Perfect.
We're thinking.
Perfect. Also, I remembered what I was going to say earlier. You said you wanted to create struggle in your life. Just
yes.
Red Rising, the whole premise, the golds.
That's one of my favorite parts
of it. The golds. We have to harden these boys.
Yeah.
And girls. You know, we have to harden them.
We got
to
harden these people.
Yeah, because the decadence of humanity and we...
Yes.
Come on. It's. But world building, what'd you give out of 5 stars?
I gave the world building, and this is one where I may raise it through our discussion.
Okay.
But I initially gave it a 3.25.
I gave 3.75. Very good. So really good.
A lot of this is, I put a lot of points into the plot in the sense of how this world was constructed and like how clear the world is with how confusing it could be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Where do I put that? Is that more of a plotting thing or is that more of a world building aspect?
Well, so when we're doing world, it's forget reality is the 5-star. No immersion is the one star. How I took it was in the plot section, that's more, hey, how many changes would you make? Lots of changes, very few changes. Of did she weave
the
it in well?
Itself, yeah.
This one, how I was looking at it was, because you don't have, it's not magic system, it's not hard sci-fi, I was purely going the tone and atmosphere, the surreal nature of it, and all the timelines I factored in, for sure. I factored in timelines of thinking she juggled a lot, and there's a vibe you get from the entire book that is surreal and strange, and she pulls it off. So I thought it was really good in that respect. Were you thinking, so you put more of that credit in plot, you said, or?
The credit on the clarity between the timelines. That's credit where I
got it.
Like, the structure of the plot was integral to make the timelines clear and understandable.
Yeah.
So I don't really put that into the world, but you're right. The tone, well done. To me, like, the aliens was fine, but a lot of the surreal aspects of it felt kind of surface level to me. And so it's just some of the extraordinary aspects of the book were just not that extraordinary. And so I was kind of hoping for a little bit more, but maybe she leaves it a little bit simpler to get to the point. Maybe that would be too distracting in this book. I'm not sure, but that's my cup of tea for it. So just how the aliens are presented was how Haber describes that, like, their totalitarian regime is just very much like, yeah, it's a brave new world and we're moving on. I'm like, okay, like, referential, but then we move along.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm just like, it's above average.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. I've clearly, she's not going for high fantasy, high sci-fi, I guess you could say, of exploring what's the society actually looking like. And I had to go purely into almost as if this was a horror read of, we just talked about Annihilation, but Annihilation's atmosphere.
Sure.
When reading that book of going, holy crap, this is weird. This is strange. This one did a really good job for me of setting me into this, into the dream world of George. I also felt like I was a part of that as well. And gave me the kind of whiplash throughout the book. I also felt the whiplash of when she was saying you can't adapt this book very well. It's just, it is weird. I'm not compelled to watch the movie because in my head, it's just, I want to keep it there rather than getting, oh, I don't want Elijah Wood to be the face of Frodo. You know, I just want to stay weird up here, because if I visualized it actually, I think it would do a worse job than my head is fantasizing about.
Completely see that.
Yeah.
It's the same reason of I wouldn't want a Piranesi movie.
Oh, no, I would hate it.
Oh, I would refuse to see it.
I think it's coming out, though. No. Or a show, I think.
I don't want to.
Because in our heads.
Oh, no.
It's just magical in our heads.
Well, no. In our heads, the house could be real or imagined. The theme of the book works when it's in my head.
Yes.
When it's put on screen, it takes something from it.
The magic, yeah.
Oh. There's something, maybe there's something to like that kind of like tribal thought or ideology with, like, there's several different tribes across the earth and through history where taking a photograph was seen as like stealing a picture, like a portion of someone's soul.
Yeah.
And so like they were against taking photographs. I wonder if there's something of like, if you took a photograph, if you took the video of the house, it loses a little bit of its majesty. Like, because now it's out of my mind and you like put it on screen. It's just not the same.
You're not a fan of scrapbooks.
No.
A lot of middle-aged moms just got really pissed.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of scrapbooks. I'll be honest. I'm not a big fan of photography in general, of like photographing your life.
Really?
I'm not a big fan of it.
I am.
You
know, I'll
take pictures. Like, my photo reel is sparse. I take photos because I have to. And like,
complicated.
One out of a hundred. I'm like, good. I'm glad I took that photo. I could delete. Like, if you told me all of my photos were gone, I would not weep. It's fine. I don't care.
Are you saying that to make me feel better about the New Zealand clips?
A little bit. I'll try and.
Because I think the way I see where you're coming from, because I know you, of on a vacation, you don't just, you're watching something, you're watching a play. How many times do people go to Disney, record the whole show, yeah, or record the whole parade and watch it through your phone and not through your eyes, and then never watch that again?
Well,
there's an extreme to it that I can agree with you.
Oh, your memory gets better. Like, you lose the details but gain nostalgia, and I like that. Of, I will always remember certain trips. Like, they're, during my hike with my dad, this big long hike, there was a moment we were at a it was early morning, hiking up this mountain, and we could see a town down below, and we were above cloud cover, and we saw like the clouds rolling in, like it looked like the waves of an ocean, but clouds going through a town.
So cool.
And that image in my head, it will always be better than whatever picture I took on my phone. I'm not looking for it. I hope I never see the photo on my phone, because it will ruin the image in my head.
So your theory, your hypothesis is image is worth 1,000 words. Your memory is worth an infinite.
Yes.
In that way. If memory is better.
Almost always. I understand, like, there's, if you're good at photography, it's instead of 1,000 words,
that's one,
it's 10,000 words. So, like,
you ever see someone, you know, paint, I mean, something and go, okay, that's better than I could ever imagine. That's pretty, yeah, damn, that's good,
pretty
painting.
Good. Yeah.
All right. All right. You know what you're doing. And yeah. So I get the extreme of you want to experience it and see it yourself. But photos to me, they spark the memory. Especially if, oh, I didn't even remember that happened. When you're old one day and looking back, you can only remember so much. And mm-hmm. you look back through kids, grandchildren, uncles, aunts, parents, and you look and go, oh, that's just seeing that sparks the cloud memory, for example. But since that was such a peak memory, you'll probably always remember that.
Sure.
God willing and all that.
But in all honesty, you are right.
You just need to be stubborn about it, right?
But no, I'm not good at photography, yeah, so it's pointless for me to do it. Like, me looking back at a crappy photo, I'm like going, yeah, that doesn't spark any good memories.
Why did I take a picture of tofu? What am I doing?
Dumb.
But there's somewhere in the middle here where I need to hear your point of view, because sometimes you can get too entrapped in, you're on vacation and want to go, I don't want to forget. I don't want, oh, picture, picture, picture. Oh, look at this moment. And you don't want to forget anything. And then you're never living the moment, obviously. But
yeah, for the most part, most things I don't want to take a picture of. I will experience it. People, I will. Like, I value older pictures of my parents and my family. That's valuable to me. And seeing a picture of me and my grandma.
Yeah.
That's a valuable picture of, like, seeing how they were and seeing how I was with them. Like, that's cool.
Yep.
A picture of my old house?
Just go to Google Maps.
Go to Google Maps. Like, I don't need to. I don't particularly need that photo. And especially when you're on vacation, you're never going to look at most of the photos you take. Like a concert, really. Like, the image of a concert is not valuable. It's the experience at a concert that is valuable. Just my general thought on it.
Hey, yeah, there's a middle ground. I do like pictures, but I do need to hear sometimes, because you need to be experience things, but also try to capture memories is generally good.
I think the best method to that is experience something,
yeah,
enjoy it, and then right before you leave, you take a picture, and then you go. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the nice, like, if your first instinct is like, take picture. Let it breathe. Let the memory, have the memory first. And then right before you leave, picture and we go.
Yeah.
So the memory is not of you taking the picture. The memory is of the experience. Mm-hmm. And the picture then comes after to remind you.
Exactly.
Rather than
experience and go, oh, I don't want to forget that good moment. Picture.
Yeah.
That's a good rule of thumb. I like that. Yeah, you might convince me to go to 3.5. I'm thinking good or really good between that range. I might go down a little bit. I do agree. It's not, there's not depth to it. I'm purely thinking of the visage in my head. That's it. That's all, sure, I got is...
The vibe is... I could be convinced to even raise it to, just because
maybe we meet in the middle. Maybe we are both wrong. We just have to...
A 3.5.
Should we agree on that?
Sure. Why
all right.
Not?
I'll go 3.5. All right. There we go. Only because of the photo discussion. yeah, because you're right. It's good. It's good.
Yeah.
I was a little antsy with my third.
The vibes are definitely better, but then like the world actual description, you get them. It's like, because does that take me a little bit out of the immersion of not, oh, I see that's a reference to Brave New World. No, I'm just like, oh, that's literally just surface level. Like, that's Brave New World, and we're moving on. Like,
The world's not as strong, too. It's not
it was purposeful. Just a reference, and then we move on. It kind of took me out of the immersion.
Okay.
And that's world building.
Yes, that's true.
It wasn't like
okay.
Brave New World with a twist or just its own thing. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you convinced me. I'll lower it. Okay. So, pros. Out of 5 stars, what'd you give it?
I gave it 4. I think it was great.
Me too.
Yeah. Great.
Great pros. 4 stars.
I think this is going to be it's going to be one of the easiest. After reading this book, I would be shocked if I ever gave Ursula K. Le Guin lower than a 3.5. Like,
or 4, really.
Or in all honesty, a 4. Like, yeah. No, she's
great. Great writer.
She's a great writer. She does, everything is super crystal clear. The details are exactly where you need to be. Clearly, not being that long of a book, she doesn't give you too many details. She goes into it.
Yeah.
And she gives you just the right amount. Personally, I would like more world building details, but that's world building. That's not prose.
Also, not the book's point.
Not the book's point. But a great way to give a message without being very preachy, I think, because the actual message and the end goal, like the end state of the book by a slightly less competent writer would have come across incredibly preachy.
Yeah.
But just the style that she wrote, it doesn't come across that way.
Yeah.
So incredibly well done.
It makes her sound like she knows what she's talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. You write very well.
Yeah.
Do you have any quotes to bring up? A passage?
That's the one thing I didn't bring.
Oh, I have one.
I didn't have that.
I have one to bring up. And you know what I love about this? Levy, this is a quote from Levy. Here's the quote.
No!
The infinite possibility.
No, he told me no!
The infinite possibility. The unlimited and unqualified wholeness of being of the... No!
I'm supposed to read it.
They have zero context.
He's not allowed to read it. He said, I have to read it.
I knew you'd forget. I knew it. I had that. I had that locked and loaded.
You did. Damn you. You knew my memory is like a sieve.
Like a jellyfish. So this quote was, Levy gave it to us in the book club. And I was like, okay, I'll read it, Levy. And then I think he said, like, no, I want Rich to read it. I'm like, no, I'm going to read it. And then Rich said, no, I'm reading it. And you said, I'm going to remember for the review. I'm reading this. I lobbed it to you. I said, do you have any quotes?
You gave me, made me look like the fool. You gave me every opportunity and I failed.
Go ahead. What's the
all
quote?
Right. The infinite possibility, the unlimited and unqualified wholeness of being, of the uncommitted, the non-acting, the uncarved, the being who, being nothing but himself, is everything. Briefly, she saw him thus, and what struck her most of that insight was his strength. He was the strongest person she had ever known, because he could not be moved away from the center. And that is why she liked him. That's so well written. That's so good.
Explains that. That's why the romance works a little better, too. Of going, oh, I see why she likes him.
Yeah. No, it's, again, slightly less poetic writer.
Yeah.
And it would just be like, oh, another sci-fi romance. But in her hands, it comes across like, you get it.
Yes.
It's not just a lustful attraction. It is an actual genuine connection of personalities.
It's the correct L word, not lust. It's actually love.
Yes. Quick love.
Yes.
But it kind of worked.
It did work, especially with how wacky the world is. Just going,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, of course. Yeah. There's aliens. I can believe this love story.
Especially with her character and how it's described of the chaotic nature of her upbringing and just how fierce she has to be. And seeing a character just, she struggles with her own identity of who she is and constantly having to fight for who, like, which community she's a part of and who she really is. And George is who he is. Nobody's going to change him. Mm-hmm. He just is. And so seeing that going like, that's a quality that she's incredibly lacking in herself and like admires in him. So works.
Yeah. And we have another quote here. This is the last one I had. If you had, you had the quote from earlier about the bread quote. You could use it. That's the love. Love doesn't just sit there like stone. It has to be made like bread, remade all the time, made new. That was the quote. And the last quote here is the end justifies the means, but what if there never is an end? All we have is means.
Honestly, that's the shortest and most succinct way of examining the problem with utilitarianism. It's honestly one of the biggest ones. Like that line right there. There never is an end. It's always like it's constantly moving forward
until the heat death.
What end? There is no end. It's all we have is our actions to get there.
Yep.
And where is there? So,
mm-hmm.
No, Ursula K. Le Guin, destroys utilitarianism. Like,
with facts and logic.
With facts and logic. And like completely owned.
I don't know. What is her? I do like that I read this and went, okay, I know. I kind of get a feeling of what she believes.
Mm-hmm.
But again, doesn't come across. She doesn't come across irritating, insulting at all. It's done with...
You see the focus of her characters. She wants to tell an interesting story with these characters and what would they do and have these interesting situations.
It feels like they're speaking, not her. That could be cringy thing of what you're saying. Oh, I just let the story speak. But it does do that.
Whatever technique, she knows how to do it.
She does. Well, that's the Lathe of Heaven review. Remember, check out World Anvil. Thank you for sponsoring this episode. Our Patreon link in the description below. At this point, we also have the link of the book. I didn't mention that earlier, but if you want to read the book we just explained as well, that's there too. Any final notes?
All we have is means, so make sure those means are well thought out and with kindness.
Yes. And don't be mean with your means.
Don't be mean with your means.
Yeah. We'll see you all next episode.
Bye, all.
Bye.